Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by Proliance Energy. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana Luncheon Series, produced by Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Today, we hear from journalist and author P.J. O'Rourke. O'Rourke is a research fellow at the Cato Institute, the former editor-in-chief of the National Lampoon, and he also served as a foreign correspondent for Rolling Stone magazine. O'Rourke was speaking on behalf of Freedom House, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that serves as a voice for democracy and freedom around the world. O'Rourke says maintaining freedom is a constant battle, and that obstacles come from the right, left, and center of the political spectrum.
It's great to be back in the Midwest. You know, I'm from Toledo, Ohio. I went to Miami of Ohio. My wife went to IU. I've lived 40 years out on the East Coast, and it's okay, but they just, you know, they think they're awful damn smart. Like those guys managing hedge funds on Wall Street, you know, that kind of smart. Or the guys managing Washington, that kind of smart. And then they're always kind of snotty about us Midwesterners, and they say things like, why is it so flat out there, you know? And I always say, so we can see you coming. Anyway, I am here today, not on my own behalf, but on behalf of Freedom House. And as was just said, we are the oldest nonpartisan pro-democracy group in America, perhaps in the world, co-founded by Eleanor Roosevelt and Wendell Willkie. Now I've got this last. You messed up his first name. I messed up his last name. William Winkie, whatever his name was. Anyway, they brought this group together in the ramp up to World War II. Because they felt America was being isolationist and we were not reaching out to promote democracy around the world. And we weren't. And that came back and that bit us hard with the Nazis and the Japanese. And it bit us again in the Cold War with the Soviet menace. And it bit us once more with the Islamic terrorists. We have to reach out and fight for democracy, not just here, but all across the world. And Freedom House does that. We do it by analysis. We publish a yearly standing of freedom around the world and a number of other analyzed bits of information about how things are going. We do that with programs. We have programs around the world to help build democracy. In countries where it's like this way, that way, programs that range from everything against violence against women in the Arab world to internet access in China to civil society and rule of law organizations in former Soviet Europe. And we do advocacy, and this is the advocacy part. We try and get people on board. With supporting freedom. You know, it's not just a matter of, you know, sending $10. It's a matter of really pushing your elected representatives. Now, the two really important things to understand about fighting for freedom are that it's pointless and it's selfish. See, I'm a Republican. I drink. Pointless and selfish. That's my territory. Let me explain. It's pointless. When you're fighting for people's freedom, you're not fighting to get people to do something. You are fighting to let people do anything, you know, anything they want. You don't have a goal when you're fighting for freedom. You are fighting to let other people have goals of their own. I mean, what free people end up doing with their freedom, that's none of your business. I mean, as long as they don't impinge on the freedom of other free people. Now, once a country has become free, it may turn out to be much more, say, socially conservative than you'd like, or may turn out to be much more socially liberal. A free country, it may turn out to be a capitalist idea of heaven, full of dog-eat-dog and winner-take-all competition, or it may turn out to be a socialist paradise filled with endless cooperative social benefit programs, whether you need them or want them or not. a free country, it could turn out to be France. not that I have anything against France. You know, I think France actually is a treasure to mankind. I mean, French ideas, French beliefs, French actions, they form a sort of lodestone for humanity because a moral compass needle needs a butt end. And whatever direction France is pointing, you know, towards Nazi collaboration or communism or existentialism or Jerry Lewis movies or opposition to the war in Iraq, we can go the other direction with a clear conscience. Now, see, I was complaining one time at Freedom House to our head of research, Arch Pudington, who's here today. I was saying about Scandinavian countries. I was saying, Arch, you know, the free enterprise freedoms are not sufficiently respected in those countries. And Arch said to me, quite wisely, he said, well, maybe so, PJ, but the people of those Scandinavian countries, they are free to change that anytime they want. Good point. Bolstering my point that freedom is pointless. Pointless and selfish. Selfish because when we fight for freedom, we are not being altruistic. It's not like donating food aid or medical care or educational facilities to the poor and the unfortunate of the world. Those are altruistic activities. They do good for others, but we get nothing from those good things ourselves, at least not in this world. But fighting for freedom is different because there's nothing that we consider so precious, hold so dear, as the freedoms that we possess. And any attack on any freedom anywhere in the world is an attack on our freedom. Ignore that attack on freedom, and sooner or later, and if the 20th century is anything to go by, probably sooner, it's going to put our own freedom at risk. And contemporary history is just full of bad examples of us failing to pursue our self-interest in freedom. I mean, there have been horrible attacks just in very recent times, in fact, probably today, horrible attacks on freedom in sub-Saharan Africa. And nobody seems to care much. Nobody seems to do much. Because Africa doesn't have oil, you know? African gross national products have not been rising. So what's the message here? The message is we don't care about your freedom if you're economically insignificant. Well, a lot of us are economically insignificant. I mean, we didn't used to be, like last year. But since this fall, I mean, I don't know what your 401k looks like, but, you know, best investment I've made lately, I left a $10 bill in the suit jacket over the holidays, and I found it this morning. Now, there have been many horrible attacks on freedom in the Islamic world, where they do have oil and where gross national products had been rising. But we don't seem to care much about freedom in the Islamic world. We care about stability in the Islamic world, even if it's an enslaved stability. We care about victory over the terrorists in the Islamic world, even if it's an oppressive victory by dictatorial forces. And what's the message there? Is the message we don't care about your freedom unless you worship the way we worship, you know? But what's the way we worship? I mean, to judge by Sunday morning scene at my local golf course, just about the time that Mass is being said, we worship, you know, by praying to get on the green in three and two-putt, right? You know? And there have been many horrible attacks on freedom in obscure places involving small minorities like South Ossetians, you know? And everybody's just too sick of these little fights in strange places to do much about South Ossetian freedoms, you know? But what's the message there? We don't care about freedom if your minority is too tiny. Well, I'm a Republican. You know, minorities don't get much tinier than that right now. You know? At least as of last night, Michelle in that dress. That'd make anybody a Democrat. So, fight for freedom. Lonely fight. Hard to get people to enlist in this fight. And as a member of the Freedom House board, I may say it's hard to raise money for this fight. Because in the fight for freedom, the goals are not clear-cut. We don't get to feel sanctimonious and filled with virtue because of our selfless charity, because we have too much personally at stake in this fight to feel like that. And what's worst of all is that fight for freedom, that is a fight that is never won. The enemies of freedom come at us from every direction. Now, the enemies of freedom famously come at us from the right wing, with the fascism of Hitler, Mussolini, Franco. And let us not forget that that fascism was a product of an international financial turmoil not too different from what we're seeing right now. Enemies of freedom, they famously come at us from the left wing. Fall of the Berlin Wall may have destroyed communism as a global military threat, but as an intellectual threat, that bad dream of coercive collectivism, that's still alive in places like North Korea and Cuba, Venezuela, and Harvard. And the enemies of freedom, the amazing thing, the enemies of freedom can come at us right from the middle, too, right from the middle of the road. You know, I mean, these, the bureaucrats, the technocrats, the red tape, the rules, the regulations, the official busybodies, these are the well-meaning enemies of freedom. Their handiwork can be seen in the riot-plagued and immigrant, riot-plagued immigrant neighborhoods of Europe. They can be seen in the crime-filled low-income housing developments right here in Indianapolis, you know. They can be seen in the Patriot Act. Even the assault on freedom in modern China is the result, to some degree, of this attack of the radical moderates. When you are a champion of freedom, you don't even have the consolation of party partisanship. There is no such thing in America or anywhere else in the world as a political party that is a true and dependable friend of freedom. Now, here in the States, we've got the Democrats. They're the party of government activism. They're the party that says government can make you richer and smarter and taller and take a dozen strokes off your golf game. And we've got the Republicans. They're the party that says government doesn't work, and then they get elected and prove it. Now, you would think on an issue as basic to the American way of life as freedom that these two parties could get together and operate with bipartisan consensus. But the fact is, the two most frightening words in politics are bipartisan consensus. Bipartisan consensus, that's like when my doctor and my lawyer agree with my wife that I need help. Democrats and Republicans working together, that's already cost us $700 billion in the Wall Street. And that's when they hate each other. You know, I mean, imagine if they started getting along. No, we don't want to depend on bipartisan. Political parties, they're always going to be the instruments of politicians. Now, this is true of political parties in free countries and in not free countries, in countries like China with only one political party, and in countries like Israel with so many political parties that if you put two Israelis in a room, you get three political parties. You know? Political parties are the instruments of politicians, and politicians are. I have covered politics for almost 40 years now. Now, I know politicians. I like politicians. I've got good friends who are politicians. Politicians are fine. They're great until they get involved in our freedoms. Then they become ratchet-jawed purveyors of monkey-doodle and baked wind. They are piddlers upon merit, beggars at the doors of accomplishment, thieves of livelihood, envy-coddling tax life of lice, applauding themselves for giving away other people's money. They are the lapdogs of the poli-sci department, returning to the vomit of collectivism. They are the pig herders tending that sow who eats her young, the obese power of the state. They are muck-dwelling bottom feeders growing fat on the worries and disappointments of the electorate. They are the ditch carp of governance. And that is what one of their friends says. You know, my day job is to make fun of politics. But after all these years of making fun of politics, I've realized I'm enjoying myself about as much as a grizzly bear getting a bikini wax. You know, I hate politics. I hate politics. And I don't hate just bad politics. I hate all politics. I even hate democracy. Imagine if our clothes were selected by the majority of shoppers, which would be teenage girls, I would be standing here with my midriff exposed. Imagine deciding what's for dinner by family secret ballot. I have got three kids and three dogs in my family. We would be having Fruit Loops and rotten meat. Politics stink. I mean, think how we use the word politics. Are office politics ever a good thing? When somebody plays politics to get a promotion, does he deserve it? When we call a coworker a real politician, is that a compliment? Politics stink. And to my mind, freedom is a room deodorizer, trying to keep the bad smell of politics out of home, school, and office. But you see, I don't blame politicians. I don't blame politicians because they lie. because just think what the truth would sound like in a political speech. Even a little bitty bit of truth. Imagine a politician anywhere in the world who stood up and said, no, I can't fix public education. The problem isn't funding or teachers' unions or lack of vouchers or absence of computer equipment in the classroom. The problem is your damn kids. Business of politics is always more corrupt even than the business of business, even in these dark times. Yeah, there are bad people in business, my broker. But personally, right now, I would rather be out looking for a loan to start a chain of O.J. Simpson sports memorabilia stores than to be trusting politics to solve my problems. Political corruption, it's a law of economics. When buying and selling are controlled by voting, the first things that get bought and sold are votes. Simple as that. Now, do our politicians understand this law? Well, they ought to. They're lawyers, you know. And incidentally, letting lawyers write laws is like outsourcing your food and drug safety inspections to China. But you can't have democracy without politics, and you can't have freedom without democracy. Democracy is inseparable from freedom. And this is not because democracy always produces wonderful results. It doesn't. Democratic Athens plunged ancient Greece into the Peloponnesian War democratically. The golden age of Greece was voted out, you know. All sorts of horrors were committed by the democratic mob during the French Revolution. And I need not remind anyone that Hitler was elected to office. No, the reason democracy is inseparable from freedom is that democracy, and only democracy, expresses the equality before the law that is freedom's foundation stone. If we are to be free, we must be equal before the law. There cannot be freedom if there is one law for some people and another law for other people. Brown versus Board of Education. Separate is not equal. But if we are equal before the law, then how can some people have a say in creating those laws while other people have no say? No way. Hence, democracy. And yet, it is the plight of the freedom fighter that democracy will always be disappointing. Freedom will always be disappointing. Freedom will always be disappointing to everybody sometimes and to some people all of the time. For one thing, equality before the law is not the same thing as fairness. In fact, in some ways, to speak for freedom is to speak for unfairness. Let me explain. I've got an 11-year-old daughter at home, and I am always hearing, that's not fair, that's not fair. And when I hear that, when she says that to me, I say to her, honey, you're cute, that's not fair. Your family's pretty well off, that's not fair. You were born in America, that's not fair. Darling, you had better pray to God that things don't start getting fair for you. Another kind of disappointment that democracy is always going to provide is just a matter of simple math. We live in a democracy, rule of the people, rule of the majority. 50% of people are below average intelligence. Simple math, you know? Explains everything about democratic politics. Republican politics, too, for that matter. Now, we don't want to live, however, in a country ruled only by the best and the brightest. That would be much too much like being married to Nancy Pelosi, you know, or working for Lehman Brothers, for that matter, you know. So we have to keep that disappointing democracy. I mean, even when democracy acts up the way it's done in Russia or in the Gaza Strip, you know, to show just how disappointing democracy will always be. Let's examine the record of our own democracy over the past 8 years. I mean, we're supposed to have one of the best democracies in the world, right? And what did we come up with over the past 8 years when my guy was in power? Crummy war, scary economy, public opinion of Congress, down around Mrs. Elliot Spitzer's opinion of her husband. voters are angry. Voters are angry. And the Republican Party, we just watched the Republican Party totally forget that there's such a thing as an angry voter. And hell, I'm an angry voter, and I'm a Republican, you know? I mean, you don't even get me started on my frustrations with the Bush administration. No child left behind. Now, what if they deserve to be left behind? What if they deserve a smack on the behind, you know? National testing program to test whether kids are what? Stupid? You've got kids. Kids are stupid. You know? Constitutional ban on gay marriage. I didn't get it. I mean, how about a constitutional ban on first marriages? Now we're talking. Homeland Security sounds like a failed online mortgage broker. You know what I mean? Bush's immigration program, fence the border, give a huge boost to the Mexican ladder industry. You know, I mean, put the National Guard on the Rio Grande and know that U.S. troops are standing between you and yard care. You know, I mean, Bush said that if illegal immigrants, if they wanted citizenship, they'd have to do three things. They'd have to pay taxes, they'd have to learn English, they'd have to work in a meaningful job. Well, Bush didn't meet two out of three of those. So given that freedom inevitably produces disappointments like George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, he'll be a disappointment too. You just wait, you know? So what do we do? Well, first, we keep in mind that democracy will disappoint us, but dictatorship will kill us. I'd rather be disappointed. Second thing we have to do is just be there. Show up. Fly the flag. Years ago, I was in South Africa, 1986, during the bad old days of apartheid. And while I was down there in Johannesburg, I drove right through the middle of Soweto, which was probably not a very wise thing for anybody as beige as me to do. Well, I was wearing a jacket, necktie, and a brand-new rental car. And, you know, I mean, they're having a lot of riots and machete fights and necklacing and stuff at the time in Soweto. But I just felt like I had to go there. I had to go there because I had been a month in South Africa, and I had yet to meet a single white person who had ever laid eyes on Soweto, even seen Soweto, even though it is as close to Johannesburg as Queens is to Manhattan. You know? White South Africans, they were real experts at out of sight, out of mind. You know? If I'd wanted to, I could have spent months and months in South Africa without seeing anything that indicated there was any trouble in that country at all, except maybe an occasional military roadblock. You know, I couldn't even find Soweto. Soweto, it's just a city of 2 million people. And I could drive all the way around the freeway network of Johannesburg and never see a sign for Soweto. Finally, I saw a little bitty marker, like it would say, you know, the kind of thing that would say, picnic area, 1 mile, you know. And it said Soweto, a little arrow. So I drove down this road and over a hill, and here is this monstrous township, the city of 2 million people. And it didn't look like I thought. It was actually kind of suburban in a way, and little houses on separate plots of lands. There were nice neighborhoods in Soweto as well as tough ones, although a lot of Soweto was horribly poor, horribly poor. I mean, dozens of people cramped in those little houses and squatters and living around the periphery and so forth. But, of course, the issue wasn't poverty. The issue was humiliation, lack of equality before the law. It wouldn't have mattered if all those houses in Soweto had been mansions, you know. The people would have been just as mad. So I drove right through the middle of Soweto, and I didn't see a single white person, not a single white person of any kind, not even a cop or a soldier. And it's Saturday afternoon, and the streets are really crowded, and I'm kind of stuck in traffic there, and I'm scared. And I started to look around, and then I realized that people were staring at me, all right. But they weren't frowning. They weren't angry or threatening. They were smiling. They were smiling at me. And some of the little kids were waving at me. And a lot of people were laughing. And I didn't know what was going on. And I'll tell you, I was not about to get out of that car and find out what was going on. Maybe these people were smiling and laughing because I was crazy to be in Soweto, you know. Or maybe they were smiling and laughing because they were crazy from being in Soweto. I couldn't figure it out. So anyway, a couple of months later, I'm back in the United States, and I'm giving a lecture at a college out here in the Midwest. And I'm telling a story about visiting Soweto. And after the lecture, this young lady comes up to the podium, and she's an exchange student at the college, and she was born and raised in Soweto. And she says, "Don't you know why those people were smiling at you?" And I said, "No, Yeah, I have no idea. And she said, well, how'd you get in? It's illegal for a white person even to be in Soweto. And they were smiling just because you came. They were happy just because you came. Maybe you were a good person, maybe you weren't a good person, but you were interested enough to come see. And that made them smile. And that is what we have to do. We have to be there. Another thing we need to do is remember that freedom, what freedom means to people at a gut level all around the world. No group is immune to freedom. No group doesn't believe in freedom. No group doesn't, at a gut personal level, desire freedom. This country is a beacon for those people around the world. Now, maybe you think the world is full of hatred for America, anger at America, anti-Americanism. And it is. It is, you know. But I was covering the Civil War in Lebanon, 1984, right in the middle of the Civil War. I'm down in the south suburbs of Beirut, in an area controlled by Hezbollah, same Hezbollah that's still there. And I get stopped at a checkpoint, and this checkpoint is manned by kids. They're just kids. They're 15, 16 years old. They're waving their guns around. They're scratching their ear with the muzzle sight and jamming the barrels down in the dirt. And they got the safeties off, you know. I mean, they're mad at me, but I'm more scared of them because they're – I mean, gun safety merit badges must go begging in the Lebanese Boy Scouts. Anyway, this kid sees my American passport, and he just takes off on me. He just starts screaming and yelling at me. And he yells at me for like half an hour, telling me how all the terrible things that are wrong in the entire world are the fault of America. You know, poverty and war and injustice and Zionism and everything is everything's America's fault. And then he gets done yelling. He hands his passport back to me, and he says, as soon as I get my green card, I am going to study dentist school in Dearborn, Michigan. 25 years ago, and I bet he's a prosperous orthodontist, you know, in Ann Arbor right now. Probably voted for McCain. Now, we mustn't forget America's role as a symbol and an instructor and a leader of freedom. At the same time, we must be very, very careful of the people, not just the politicians, but the people who want all of the graces and favors of freedom without any of freedom's sacrifice and humility. So there are a lot of individuals in the world who claim to be friends of freedom and don't really want freedom, at least for other people. Everybody wants it for themselves, but not so many people want for others. There are a lot of individuals who say freedom, but what they mean is license or lawlessness or permission to grab anything I can. You know? Freedom has many insincere lovers. Now, Ronald Reagan used to tell a joke about the kind of people who use their claim of love for freedom and democracy to take the good things that freedom offers while undermining the individual liberty and equality before the law that freedom requires. President Reagan said these people were treating freedom the way that the farmer treated a pig. A traveling salesman stays overnight with a farm family, and when the family gathers to eat, there's a pig sitting right there at the table with the family. And the pig has got three medals hanging around its neck and a wooden leg. And the salesman's a little taken back. He says, I see you've got a pig eating dinner right here with you at the table. Yep, says the farmer. That's because that's a very special pig. See those medals around his neck? Well, first medal, that's from when our youngest son fell in the pond. And he was drowning, and that pig swam out and saved his life. Second medal, that's from when the barn caught fire. Our little daughter was trapped inside there, and the pig ran in and carried her out and saved her life. And the third medal, that's from when our oldest boy was cornered in the stockyard by a mean bull, and that pig ran under the fence and bit the bull on the tail, and the boy got away and saved the boy's life. Wow, says the salesman, I can see why you let that pig sit right here at the table. That really is a special pig, and I can see why you awarded him the medals. How do you get the wooden leg? Farmer says, well, pig like that, you don't eat them all at once. Okay, that's everything I know. But we got some questions here. I'll make up some other stuff.
Thank you, PJ, for that entertaining and thoughtful discussion. Several good questions here about the new president. And first of all is, how do you think his approach to global diplomacy, or maybe more so in terms of how we're going to be impacting democracy around the world, how will it differ from the Bush administration?
Well, God, I don't know. You know, I mean, the first thing that he did in terms of diplomatic was name Hillary Clinton to be Secretary of State. And I had this wholly unexpected shiver of warm fellow feeling for Mohammed Ahmadinejad. He's going to have to deal with her. I'm thinking I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy, who would be Mohammed Ahmadinejad, you know. And I'm thinking all around the world, people going, you know, the Sri Lankans and the Tamil Tigers, the Palestinians and the Israelis, Pakistanis and the Indians all going, no, please, you know, please, we'd rather kill each other than be nagged to death by you. You know? I'm not sure. Then Hillary gave in her acceptance speech, she gave a speech in which democracy was not mentioned as a goal of American foreign policy or as one of her, priorities. And that concerns me. So I think the good part of Obama is he's going to have a lot of international goodwill. The downside is that he's named somebody as the point person for his diplomacy that doesn't even have much goodwill at home. So we'll see.
Another question about the new president. Several commentators have said we really don't know what Obama stands for or what he really believes, that he's been all generality and very few specifics. What's your view? And by the way, they put on here, go Miami U.
Go Miami. Redskins. Yeah. Although they've changed the name to Dust Bunnies or something. Political correctness. Running for president of the United States, you've been crazy to be specific about anything. You know, there are no specific solutions to the problems we face in the world, or somebody would have used them. You know, Bush is incompetent, maybe, but he's not that incompetent. If there were easy fixes, he would have made them, you know. And so Obama is going to find himself depending on those generalities. We just have to hope that he has caution and common sense and that he doesn't create a kind of government that overreaches itself, that for the sake of political symbolism does something like nationalize the banks or nationalize the stock market we had a situation like this in 1929. We brought in a beloved and hopeful president with a lot of vague generalities, and he behaved in such a way that it prolonged that depression all the way until we got to a war. And we don't want that. We don't want more war, and we certainly don't want a decade of depression. So let's just hope that let's hope he stays general and vague, and because as far as I'm concerned, as far as he is a Democrat, a typical liberal Democrat, I can only hope for his failure. And I don't want to do that on his first day of presidency. I wish him success in vagueness.
You mentioned the economic crisis, and this next one's a follow-up there. Is there any reason to suppose that our government today can resolve the economic crisis in a way less threatening to freedom than was done in the 1930s?
Well, practically anything would be less threatening to freedom than our government's behavior in the 1930s. The great way for the government to deal with this financial crisis is to simply let it happen. There probably is, I don't know, you know, there's some argument about getting credit flowing again, but basically we've had a huge asset bubble. In fact, our asset bubble has grown so large and so euphoric, to use the Greenspan words, not that he did much about it, that we got to a point where debt was seen as an asset. I mean, a lot of this problem that we're having here is debt seen as an asset, where you go to your buddies and say, boy, did I make a lot of debt today. I borrowed so much money. I borrowed a bunch more money than you did. You say, yeah, but I'm going to borrow even more next week, you know, and I'll be, you know, even more in the hole than you. You know? Look at all this debt I'm holding here. It's like moon mortgages, you know, and like, you know, Martian credit swaps and stuff. So there's no way out of this asset bubble except that the assets be more sensibly revalued, which means that they will initially fall well below. I mean, it's not like they have a real value. You know, I mean, the value is that's the thing about the free market that many liberals don't seem to understand. The free market is just a yardstick. It's nothing else. You cannot take that stick, beat the horse of the economy with it, and make it giddy up. The free market is nothing but a measurement of what people are willing to pay for any given thing at any given moment. We got way, way up that yardstick. We're going to have to come down. Then we'll have a dead cat bounce, and we'll come back into the middle, and there'll be some, you know. But we have to let those worthless assets deflate, or those overvalued assets deflate to a more sensible level before we get out of this. Anything the government can do to help that happen is a good thing. Anything that it does to put off the pain of that is probably a bad thing.
Got a question here. You were, in your remarks, critical of the Republican Party, and this actually comes from somebody talking about the current state of the Republican Party and its sort of its failure to attend to the needs of the conservative base, and it's spawned guys like Ron Paul and other sort of libertarian types who have warned of the dangers ahead and then were promptly vilified. Do you see this trend changing in the future, and where do you see libertarianism in the GOP in the future?
Well, I think that the GOP has long been divided between social conservatives and libertarians. And the libertarians tend to take a pragmatic view towards government and tend to want to stay out of debates like abortion, whereas the social conservatives want government to be more like the Democrats do, that is, to be socially activist and to get involved to do things like prevent gay marriage and make abortion illegal. I try to be a decent Catholic. I am convinced that abortion is a terrible sin. I think it's wrong, but you know, look at the Ten Commandments. How many of them can be turned into laws? Honor thy father and thy mother. That's going to be tricky, you know. Don't envy your neighbor's wife. You know, I mean, that's going to be really tricky. You know? And so on. You know, it's just that it is not. The government has a limited purview, and the law can only deal with certain aspects of human behavior. And I think that the social conservatives should rely on fighting their fight. I'm not saying they're wrong, but I think they should fight their social fight socially, not look to politics to fight that fight. I would say the same thing to the sort of crunchy granola type Democrats, you know, with their visualized world peace bumper stickers and so on. You know? Go think globally and act locally, for Pete's sake. You know, get out of my voting booth. You know, that if you want the kind of social change of sharing and caring and all this, you know, and organic everything, go make the social fight that fight socially. Don't fight that fight politically. The law cannot deal with trifles, and the law cannot deal with certain areas of morality that are between you and your conscience, your God, and so on. And so I think that the other thing is the Republican Party has to become, we're a two-party system, and both parties have to be inclusive. And it can't be the old white guy party. You know, I got an old white guy at home. You know, I see him every morning when I shave. And I don't need any more old white guys. You know? We have to, Republicans have to broaden their minds, and they also have to broaden their physical base. The Republican message should be a message that with appeal, I'm not going to say everybody was going to agree with it, but it should have some appeal to everybody. That's one thing I will say for the Democrats. When a Democrat gets up and he says, we're going to make the whole, you know, we're going to cure poverty, we're going to make sure that everybody gets medical treatment, we're going to make sure that everybody has a medical insurance, we're going to make sure that all retirees have a comfortable life, that message is appealing. It's appealing to me. Now, I know in my rational mind that all those promises can't be delivered or that the price for fulfilling those promises will be dreadful. I mean, economic stagnation, a high rate of structural unemployment, a European situation. you know, where people are frozen in the world that they're born in. You know, if you're a butcher's son, you remain a butcher's son. You know, if you get a job when you're 19, you never ever change that job, and so on. I know I don't want that world, but nonetheless, the message: we're going to eliminate poverty, we're going to eliminate sickness, we're going to eliminate this, that, and the other thing. It's an appealing message. The Republicans have to have a message that appeals to everybody. Also, those people say, "Oh, I don't know. You know, I think that's going to." I don't know if I'd actually vote for that Republican because I think the things he promises are going to be too expensive as far as I'm concerned. It's going to cost, cost me too much worry or cost me too much insecurity. But they should at least be appealing. And as it is, I don't think the Republican message appeals to a broad enough group of people.
Follow-up question. How close are we or are we past the inflection point between capitalism and socialism?
Oh, no, we're not on the socialist side of the scale yet. The real way to measure this is how much of the gross domestic product is politically managed, how much of it is dirigiste, to use the economist. Now, at the moment, about a third of our gross domestic product is under some degree of government control. However, a large part of that third is in entitlement programs, and while the government may redistribute this money, it doesn't have too much to say about how people spend it, for instance, Social Security. The government may act as a sort of churning mechanism or a kind of a conveyor belt, taking money from one pocket of the public and putting it in another pocket, but it does not command how that money is then spent. And the same is true of a number of other government entitlement programs. So I think as long as you have the majority of economic activity not being determined in Congress or city council, you're probably in fairly good shape. Are we pushing it? Are we getting to a point? Are we at a point where too much of our economy is controlled politically? Yes. Are we pushing more in that direction right now? Certainly, yes. You know, is it something to be worried about? Definitely, yes. Are we already in hell and just didn't notice because it's air conditioned? No.
Taking this even a little bit further, somebody wants to know is very philosophical, but is the Bill of Rights necessary?
Is the Bill of Rights necessary? The British don't feel so. The British feel that those things are covered by common law. But I think that in America, probably because we were started from scratch and that we're a singularity, and certainly in 1776 we were a very considerable singularity. There was no other place like this in the world, and they were doing everything de novo. You know, and so spelling out the – we didn't have ancient rights and traditions because we weren't an ancient country. And so they had to be spelled out. So I think for us, the Bill of Rights was extremely important. And I think that the British probably should have a better recognition of how important these rights may be covered by British common law, but notice how easily they are infringed upon. It's virtually impossible to own a pistol in Britain. And it's very difficult to own a long arm. Constraints upon your freedom of speech. Their form of the libel law, we would have put most people during the last half of the Bush administration, would have put most people in America in jail for what they said about Bush. You know, you couldn't do that in Britain. People can sue you for that kind of stuff. And I think that it's very necessary.
A little closer to home, and we were talking about this over lunch, but if you could just comment on the state of freedom and democracy in our neighbors to the south, all the way from Mexico to Brazil and Argentina.
Well, the besetting problem of freedom in Latin America, and it's a besetting problem of freedom in many parts of the world, is that the political mechanism is seen as the main lever for change of all kinds in society, both on a national and a personal level. The instinct there is to go for political control if you want to make money. Go for political control if you want more land. Go for political control if you want larger pensions. Go for political control if you want higher wages. Everything is thought to center around having political control. The concept of government is that you have a nation state and politics runs this nation state, and this nation state distributes all the good things in life to you. There isn't an idea that you make the money, you find the land, you get an education, you get a better job, and the government takes its little slice off the top in order to, you know, provide sewers and the Marine Corps. You know, that's our concept of government. That concept is rare around the world. And as long as people have this, one might call it too much faith in politics, certainly one would call it too much dependence on politics, as long as they do that, they're going to have a couple of things. First place, government's going to try and do more than it can. The second place is it's going to be a winner-take-all political contests are going to be a winner-take-all situation. So there's likely to be violence if there's after a close race. Look what happened here with Gore and Bush. Gore won the popular vote. Bush, I guess, won the, who knows? Well, you know, any riots? No, everybody was so bored with the thing. Oh, for Pete's sake, why don't you just be president? And Gore didn't go out there. I love the idea of Gore leading a guerrilla insurrection. Somehow I don't think they would have gotten too far. But nonetheless, he didn't try, you know, and bless him. And as a matter of fact, he caved. He gave in. And that was a brilliant thing to do. Democracy is about losing. Democracy is not about me winning, my side winning this election. It's about us saying, well, you know, he got more votes, and good luck to him, you know, and I hope he doesn't. Hope he does well, doesn't do too much damage, and, you know, we'll be back at you in 4 years. That's what democracy is really about. But you can't have that. If politics determines every aspect of your life, then you've got to fight for that life. And when your side wins, you have to take to the streets. Or your side loses, you have to take to the streets or take to the mountains. We don't want that.
P.J. O'Rourke, you really make us think and you make us laugh, and we really are very glad to have had you as our guest today.
While freedom is a big issue for a lot of Americans, these days the economy and jobs are the biggest priority. Jim Shella is the State House reporter for Wish TV News Channel 8. He spends a lot of time reporting on economic policy issues, including how the state of Indiana is going to spend money from the federal economic stimulus package.
There's going to be a battle over where it goes. We don't know yet how much and what sort of strings will be attached. The governor keeps saying that he's lobbying for as few strings as possible. The Democrats who control the Indiana House of Representatives want to have a say in where that money goes, and they've got a bill that's in committee right now that would require them to have a say in how the money is spent. So there's going to be a fight over that, and I think that you'll find that the Democrats want a lot of it to go to local road projects and to schools. The governor is not opposed to road projects or local road projects for that matter, but he keeps saying that this is one-time money and so it should go to one-time causes. There are lots of possibilities. In the Daniels administration budget proposal, he eliminated some life sciences funding, and that strikes me as something that could be defined as a one-time only, and you could simply replace the money that he cut out there. There is an unemployment insurance trust fund that has been spending money faster than it has been coming in. And the state, at the end of 2008, borrowed $300 million from the federal government. There was a hearing last week at the State House on this matter where legislators were told that by June there would be a deficit of about $500 million unless something is done. The question is what to do. The money has to come from somewhere. Currently, it comes from employers who are, in effect, taxed, and currently the tax is not high enough to match the benefit level. Now, you can reduce benefit levels. You can change benefit eligibility. The Indiana Chamber of Commerce has recommended taxing employees. I don't think that's a very popular idea. Or you can hike the tax on employers. The governor hasn't provided any guidance at this point, primarily because he doesn't want to be the guy who proposes a tax increase of any kind. Of course, neither do legislators. There's a bipartisan consensus that a solution to this problem needs to be found, but somebody's going to have to suggest one here pretty soon. And it's a pretty touchy subject.
That's Jim Shella, State House reporter for Wish TV, and he's also the host of Indiana Week in Review. Next month, the Economic Club of Indiana welcomes Scott Hodge. Hodge is president of the Tax Foundation in Washington, D.C., and he's recognized as one of Washington's innovative thinkers on tax policy, the federal budget, and government spending. During the 1990s, Hodge led the campaign to include the $500 per child credit and capital gains tax cuts in the Contract with America. Hodge will speak to the Economic Club February 5th. This has been a production of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks for listening.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.